The plane to the island was an aging Cessna Caravan, a 20-seater that was stuffed with well-fed North Americans, too wide for the narrow seats. But Mac didn't mind. He gazed out the window, down to the brilliant aquamarine water 3,000 feet below, warm, salty water in which he would soon be swimming. On the island, and north of the main town of San Pedro, he found a room at a quaint little waterfront place called Rico's Reef Resort. All rooms were thatched roof cabins, each with a small front porch. Each porch had a long hammock, leaving little doubt as to the priorities at Rico's. He paid cash for a week, no credit cards ever again, and quickly changed into his new work clothes. T-shirt, old denim shorts, baseball cap, no shoes. He soon found the watering hole, ordered a rum drink, and met a man named Kaz. Kaz anchored one end of the teakwood bar and gave the impression that he had been attached to it for quite some time. His long gray hair was pulled back into a ponytail. His skin was burned bronze and leathery. His accent was faded New England. And before long, Kaz, chain-smoking and drinking dark rum, let it slip that at one time he'd been involved with a vaguely undefined firm in Boston. He poked and prodded into Mac's background, but Mac was too nervous to divulge anything. "How long you staying?" Kaz asked. "Long enough to get a tan," Mac answered. "Might take a while. Watch the sun, it's brutal." Kaz had advice for lots of things in Belize. When he realized he was getting little from his drinking buddy, he said, "You're smart. Don't talk too much around here. You got a lot of Yanks running from something." Later in the hammock, Mac rocked with the breeze, gazed at the ocean, listened to the surf, sipped a rum and soda, and asked himself if he was really running. There were no warrants, court orders, or creditors chasing him, at least none he was aware of, nor did he expect any. He could go home tomorrow if he chose, but that thought was distasteful. Home was gone. Home was something he had just escaped. The shock of leaving weighed heavy, but the rum certainly helped. Mac spent the first week either in the hammock or by the pool, carefully soaking up the sun before hustling back to the porch for a reprieve. When he wasn't napping, tanning, or loitering at the bar, he took long walks by the water. "A companion would be nice," he said to himself. He chatted with the tourists at the small hotels and fishing lodges, and finally got lucky with a pleasant young lady from Detroit. At times he was bored, but being bored in Belize was far better than being bored in Clanton. On March 25th, Mac awoke from a bad dream. For some awful reason, he remembered the date because a new term of Chancery Court began on that day in Clanton, and under usual circumstances, Mac would be at the docket call in the main courtroom. There, along with 20 other lawyers, he would answer when his name was called and inform the judge that Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so were present and ready to get their divorce. He had at least three on the docket for that day. Sadly, he could still remember their names. It was nothing but an assembly line, and Mac was a lowly paid and very replaceable worker. Lying naked under thin sheets, he closed his eyes. He inhaled and sniffed the musty oak and leather smell of the old courtroom. He heard the voices of the other lawyers as they bickered importantly over the last-minute details. He saw the judge in his faded black robe sitting low in a massive chair, waiting impatiently for papers to sign to dissolve yet another marriage made in heaven. Then Mac opened his eyes, and as he watched the slow, silent spin of the ceiling fan and listened to the early morning sounds of the ocean, he was suddenly and thoroughly consumed with the joys of freedom. He quickly pulled on some gym shorts and ran down the beach to a pier that jutted 200 feet into the water. Sprinting, he raced along the pier and never slowed as it came to an end. Mac was laughing as he launched himself through the air and landed in a mighty splash. The sauna-like water pushed him to the top, and he started swimming. Casino. Clanton's most ambitious hustler was a tractor dealer named Bobby Carl Leach. From a large gravel sales lot on the highway north of town, Bobby Carl built an empire that, at one time or another, included a backhoe and dozer service, a fleet of pulpwood trucks, 2 all-you-can-eat catfish cabins, a motel, some raw timberland upon which the sheriff found marijuana in cultivation, and a collection of real estate that primarily comprised empty buildings scattered around Clanton. Most of them eventually burned. Arson followed Bobby Carl, as did litigation. He was no stranger to lawsuits. Indeed, he loved to brag about all the lawyers he kept busy. With a colorful history of shady deals, divorces, IRS audits, fraudulent insurance claims, and near indictments, Bobby Carl was a small industry unto himself, at least to the local bar association. And though he was always in the vicinity of trouble, he had never been seriously prosecuted. Over time, his ability to elude the law added to his reputation, and most of Clanton enjoyed repeating and embellishing stories about Bobby Carl's dealings. His car of choice was a Cadillac DeVille, always maroon and new and spotless. He traded every 12 months for the latest model. No one else dared drive the same car. He once bought a Rolls Royce, the only one within 200 miles, but kept it less than a year. When he realized such an exotic vehicle had little impact on the locals, he got rid of it. They had no idea where it was made and how much it cost. None of the mechanics in town would touch it, not that it mattered, because they couldn't find parts for it anyway. He wore cowboy boots with dangerously pointed toes, starched white shirts, and dark three-piece suits, the pockets of which were always stuffed with cash. And every outfit was adorned with an astonishing collection of gold. Thick watches, bulky neck chains, bracelets, belt buckles, collar pins, tie bars. Bobby Carl gathered gold the way some women hoard shoes. There was gold trim in his cars, office, briefcases, knives, portrait frames, even his plumbing fixtures. He liked diamonds, too. The IRS could not keep track of such portable wealth, and its black market was a natural shopping place for Bobby Carl. Gaudy as he was in public, he was fanatical about his private life. He lived quietly in a weird contemporary home deep in the hills east of Clanton, and the fact that so few people had ever seen the place fueled rumors that it was used for all sorts of illegal and immoral activities. There was some truth to these rumors. A man of his status quite naturally attracted women of the looser variety, and Bobby Carl loved the ladies. He married several of them, always to his regret. He enjoyed booze, but never to excess. There were wild friends and rowdy parties, but Bobby Carl Leach never missed an hour of work because of a hangover. Money was much too important. At 5 o'clock every morning, including Sundays, his maroon DeVille made a quick loop around the Ford County Courthouse in downtown Clanton. The stores and offices were always empty and dark, and this pleased him greatly. Let him sleep. The bankers and lawyers and real estate agents and merchants who told stories about him while they envied his money were never at work at 5 o'clock in the morning. He relished the darkness and tranquility, the absence of competition at that hour. After his daily victory lap, he sped away to the office, which was on the side of his tractor sales lot and was, without question, the largest in the county. It covered the second floor of an old red brick building built before Pearl Harbor, and from behind its darkly tinted windows, Bobby Carl could keep an eye on his tractors while also watching the highway traffic. Alone and content at that early hour, he began each day with a pot of strong coffee, which he drained as he read his newspapers. He subscribed to every daily he could get, Memphis, Jackson, Tupelo, and the weeklies from the surrounding counties. Reading and gulping coffee with a vengeance, he combed the papers not for the news, but for the opportunities. Buildings for sale, farmland, foreclosures, factories coming and going, auctions, bankruptcies, liquidations, requests for bids, bank mergers, upcoming public works. The walls of his office were covered with plats of land and aerial photos of towns and counties. The local land rolls were in his computer. He knew who was behind on their property taxes and for how long and how much, and he gathered and stored this information in the pre-dawn hours while everyone else was asleep. His greatest weakness, far ahead of women and whiskey, was gambling. He had a long and ugly history with Las Vegas and poker clubs and sports bookies. He routinely dropped serious cash at the dog track in West Memphis and once nearly bankrupted himself on a cruise to Bermuda. And when casino gambling arrived, quite unexpectedly in Mississippi, his empire began taking on worrisome levels of debt. Only one local bank would deal with him anyway, and when he tapped out there to cover his losses at the craps table, he was forced to hock some gold in Memphis to meet his payroll. Then a building burned. He bullied the insurance company into a settlement, and his cash crisis abated for the moment. The Choctaw Indians built the only landlocked casino in the state. It was in Neshoba County, 2 hours south of Clanton, and there one night Bobby Carl rolled the dice for the last time. He lost a small fortune, and driving home under the influence, he swore he would never gamble again. Enough was enough. It was a sucker's game. There was an excellent reason the smart boys kept building new casinos. Bobby Carl Leach considered himself a smart boy. His research soon revealed that the Department of the Interior recognized 562 tribes of Native Americans across the country, but only the Choctaw in Mississippi. The state had once been covered with Indians, at least 19 major tribes, but most had been forcibly relocated in the 1830s and sent to Oklahoma. Only 3,000 Choctaw remained, and they were prospering nicely from their casino. Competition was needed. Further research revealed that at one time the second largest population had belonged to the Yazoo, and long before the white men arrived, their territory had covered virtually all of what is now the north half of Mississippi, including Ford County. Bobby Carl paid a few bucks to a genealogical research firm which produced a suspicious family tree that purported to prove that his father's great-grandfather had been 1/16th Yazoo. A business plan began to take shape. 30 miles west of Clanton, on the Polk County line, there was a country grocery store owned by a slightly dark-skinned old man with long braided hair and turquoise on every finger. He was known simply as Chief Larry, primarily because he claimed to be a full-blooded Indian and had papers to prove it. He was a Yazoo and proud of it. And to convince folks of his authenticity, he stocked all manner of cheap Indian artifacts and souvenirs, along with the eggs and cold beer. A teepee made in China sat next to the highway, and there was a lifeless, geriatric black bear asleep in a cage by the door. Since Chief's was the only store within 10 miles, he managed a decent traffic from the locals and some gas and a snapshot from the occasional lost tourist. Chief Larry was an activist of sorts. He seldom smiled, and he gave the impression that he carried the weight of his long-suffering and forgotten people. He wrote angry letters to congressmen and governors and bureaucrats, and their responses were tacked to the wall behind the cash register. At the slightest provocation, he would launch into a bitter diatribe against the latest round of injustices imposed upon his people. History was a favorite topic, and he would and could go on for hours about the colorful and heartbreaking theft of his land. Most of the locals knew to keep their comments brief as they paid for their goods. A few, though, enjoyed pulling up a chair and letting Chief rant. For almost 2 decades, Chief Larry had been tracking down other Yazoo descendants in the area. Most of those he wrote to had no inkling of their Indian heritage and certainly wanted no part of it. They were thoroughly assimilated, mixed, intermarried, and ignorant of his version of their gene pool. They were white. This was, after all, Mississippi, and any hint of tainted blood meant something far more ominous than a little ancestral frolicking with the natives. Of those who bothered to write back, almost all claimed to be of Anglo stock. Two threatened to sue him, and one threatened to kill him. But he labored on, and when he had organized a motley crew of 24 desperate souls, he founded the Yazoo Nation and made application to the Department of the Interior. Years passed. Gambling arrived on reservations throughout the country, and suddenly Indian land became more valuable. When Bobby Carl decided he was part Yazoo, he quietly got involved. With the help of a prominent law firm in Tupelo, pressure was applied to the proper places in Washington, and official tribal status was granted to the Yazoo. They had no land, but then none was needed under federal guidelines. Bobby Carl had the land, 40 acres of scrub brush and loblolly pine, just down the highway from Chief Larry's teepee. When the charter arrived from Washington, the proud new tribe met in the rear of Chief's store for a ceremony. They invited their congressman, but he was occupied at the Capitol. They invited the governor, but there was no response. They invited other state officials, but more important duties called them. They invited the local politicians, but they, too, were working too hard elsewhere. Only a lowly and pale-faced undersecretary of some strain showed up from the DOI and handed over the paperwork. The Yazoo, most as pale-faced as the bureaucrat, were nonetheless impressed by the moment. Not surprisingly, Larry was unanimously elected as chief for a lifetime. There was no mention of a salary, but there was a lot of talk about a home, a piece of land on which they could build an office or a headquarters, a place of identity and purpose. The following day, Bobby Carl's maroon DeVille slid into the gravel parking lot at Chief's. He had never met Chief Larry and had never stepped inside the store. He took in the fake teepee, noticed the peeling paint on the exterior walls, sneered at the ancient gas pumps, stopped at the bear's cage long enough to determine that the creature was in fact alive, then walked inside to meet his blood brother. Fortunately, Chief had never heard of Bobby Carl Leach. Otherwise, he might have sold him a diet soda and wished him farewell. After a few sips, and after it became obvious that the customer was in no hurry to leave, Chief said, "You live around here?" "Other side of the county," Bobby Carl said as he touched a fake spear that was part of an Apache warrior set on a rack near the counter. "Congratulations on the federal charter," he said. Chief's chest swelled immediately, and he offered his first smile. "Well, thank you. How'd you know? Was it in the paper?" "No, I just heard. I'm part Yazoo." With that, the smile instantly vanished, and Chief's black eyes focused harshly on Bobby Carl's expensive wool suit, vest, starched white shirt, loud paisley tie, gold bracelets, gold watch, gold cufflinks, gold belt buckle, all the way down to the javelin-tipped cowboy boots. Then he studied the hair, tinted and permed, with little strands wiggling and bouncing around the ears. The eyes were bluish-green, Irish and shifty. Chief, of course, preferred someone who resembled himself, someone with at least a few Native American characteristics. But these days, he had to take what he could get. The gene pool had become so shallow that calling oneself a Yazoo was all that mattered. "It's true," Bobby Carl pressed on. Then he touched his inside coat pocket. "I have documentation." Chief waved him off. "No, it's not necessary. A pleasure, Mr. Leach, Bobby Carl Leach." Over a sandwich, Bobby Carl explained that he was well acquainted with the chief of the Choctaw Nation and suggested that the two great men meet. Chief Larry had long envied the Choctaw for their standing and their efforts to preserve themselves. He had also read about their wildly profitable casino business, the proceeds of which supported the tribe, built schools and clinics, and sent the young people away to college on scholarship. Bobby Carl, the humanitarian, seized upon the social advances of the Choctaw due to their wisdom in tapping into the white man's lust for gambling and drinking. The following day, they left for a tour of the Choctaw Reservation. Bobby Carl drove and talked nonstop, and by the time they arrived at the casino, he had convinced Chief Larry that they, the proud Yazoo, could duplicate the venture and prosper as a young nation. The Choctaw chief was curiously tied up with other business, but an underling provided a half-hearted tour of the sprawling casino and hotel, as well as the two 18-hole golf courses, convention center, and private airstrip, all in a very rural part of Neshoba County. "He's afraid of competition," Bobby Carl whispered to Chief Larry as their tour guide showed them around with no enthusiasm whatsoever. Driving home, Bobby Carl laid out the deal. He would donate the 40-acre tract of land to the Yazoo. The tribe would finally have a home. And on the land, they would build themselves a casino. Bobby Carl knew an architect and a contractor and a banker, and he knew the local politicians, and it was clear that he had been planning this for some time. Chief Larry was too dazed and too unsophisticated to ask many questions. The future suddenly held great promise, and money had little to do with it. Respect was the issue. Chief Larry had dreamed of a home for his people, a definable place where his brothers and sisters could live and prosper and try to recapture their heritage. Bobby Carl was dreaming too, but his dreams had little to do with the glory of a long-lost tribe. His deal would give him a half interest in the casino, and for this he would donate 40 acres, secure financing for the casino, and hire the lawyers to satisfy the hands-off and distracted regulators. Since the casino would be on Indian land, there was actually very little to be regulated. The county and state certainly couldn't stop them. This had already been settled by prior litigation around the country. At the end of the long day, and over a soft drink in the back of the chief's store, the two blood brothers shook hands and toasted the future. The 40-acre tract changed owners. The bulldozers shaved every inch of it. The lawyers charged ahead. The bank finally saw the light. And within a month, Clanton was consumed with the horrific news that a casino was coming to Ford County. For days, the rumors raged in the coffee shops around the square, and in the courthouse and downtown offices, there was talk of little else. Bobby Carl's name was linked to the scandal from the very beginning, and this gave it an air of ominous credibility. It was a perfect fit for him, just the type of immoral and profitable venture that he would pursue with a vengeance. He denied it in public and confirmed it in private, and leaked it to anyone he deemed worthy of spreading it. When the first concrete was poured 2 months later, there was no ceremonial shoveling of dirt by local leaders, no speeches with promises of jobs, none of the usual posturing for cameras. It was a non-event by design, and had it not been for a cub reporter acting on a tip, the commencement of construction would have gone unnoticed. However, the following edition of the Ford County Times ran a large front-page photo of a cement truck with workers around it. The headline screamed, "Here comes the casino." A brief report added few details, primarily because no one wanted to talk. Chief Larry was too busy behind the meat counter. Bobby Carl Leach was out of town on urgent business. The Bureau of Indian Affairs within the DOI was thoroughly uncooperative. An anonymous source did contribute by confirming off the record that the casino would be open in about 10 months. The front page story and photo confirmed the rumors, and the town erupted. The Baptist preachers got themselves organized, and the following Sunday unloaded vile condemnations of gambling and its related evils upon their congregations. They called their people to action. Write letters. Call your elected officials. Keep an eye on your neighbors to make sure they don't succumb to the sin of gambling. They had to stop this cancer from afflicting their community. The Indians were attacking again. The next edition of the Times was laden with screeching letters to the editor, and not a single one supported the idea of a casino. Satan was advancing on them, and all decent folks should circle the wagons to fend off evil intentions. When the County Board of Supervisors met as usual on a Monday morning, the meeting was moved into the main courtroom to accommodate the angry crowd. The five supervisors hid behind their lawyer, who tried to explain to the mob that there was nothing the county could do to stop the casino. It was a federal issue, plain and simple. The Yazoo had been officially recognized. They owned the land. Indians had built casinos in at least 26 other states, usually with local opposition. Lawsuits had been filed by concerned citizens, and they had lost every one of them. Was it true that Bobby Carl Leach was the real force behind the casino? Someone demanded. The lawyer had been drinking with Bobby Carl two nights earlier. He couldn't deny what the entire town suspected. "I believe so," he said cautiously, "but we are not entitled to know everything about the casino. And besides, Mr. Leach is of Yazoo descent." A wave of raucous laughter swept through the room, followed by boos and hissing. "He'd claim to be a midget if he could make a buck," someone yelled, and this caused even more laughter, more jeers. They yelled and booed and hissed for an hour, but the meeting eventually ran out of gas. It became obvious that the county could do nothing to stop the casino. And so it went. More letters to the editor, more sermons, more phone calls to elected officials, a few updates in the newspaper. As the weeks and months dragged on, the opposition lost interest. Bobby Carl lay low and was seldom seen around town. He was, however, at the construction site every morning by 7, yelling at the superintendent and threatening to fire someone. The Lucky Jack Casino was finished just over a year after the Yazoo Charter arrived from Washington. Everything about it was cheap. The gaming hall itself was a hastily designed combination of 3 prefab metal buildings wedged together and fronted with fake facades of white brick and lots of neon. A 50-room hotel was attached to it and designed to be as towering as possible, with 6 floors of small, cramped rooms available for $49.95 a night. It was the tallest building in the county. Inside the casino, the motif was Wild West, cowboys and Indians, wagon trains, gunslingers, saloons, and teepees. The walls were plastered with garish paintings of Western battle scenes, with the Indians having the slight advantage in body count, if anyone cared to notice. The floors were covered with a thin, tacky carpet inlaid with colorful images of horses and livestock. The atmosphere was that of a rowdy convention hall thrown together as quickly as possible to attract gamblers. Bobby Carl had handled most of the design. The staff was rushed through training. 100 new jobs, Bobby Carl retorted to anyone who criticized his casino. Chief Larry was outfitted in full Yazoo ceremonial garb, or at least his version of it, and his routine was to roam the gambling floor and chat with the clients and make them feel as though they were on real Indian territory. Of the 24 official Yazoo, 15 signed up for work. They were given headbands and feathers and taught how to deal blackjack, one of the more lucrative jobs. The future was full of plans: a golf course, convention center, an indoor pool, and so on. But first they had to make some money. They needed gamblers. The opening was without fanfare. Bobby Carl knew that cameras and reporters and too much attention would scare away many of the curious, so the Lucky Jack opened quietly. He ran ads in the newspapers in the surrounding counties with promises of better odds and luckier slots and the largest poker room in Mississippi. It was a blatant falsehood, but no one would dare contest it in public. Business was slow at first. The locals were indeed staying away. Most of the traffic was from surrounding counties, and few of the first gamblers cared to spend the night. The high-rise hotel was empty. Chief Larry had almost no one to talk to as he roamed the floor. After the first week, word spread around Clanton that the casino was in trouble. Experts on the subject held forth in the coffee shops around the square. Several of the braver ones admitted to visiting the Lucky Jack and happily reported that the place was virtually deserted. The preachers crowed from their pulpits. Satan had been defeated. The Indians had been crushed once again. After 2 weeks of lackluster activity, Bobby Carl decided it was time to cheat. He found an old girlfriend, one willing to have her face splashed across the newspapers, and rigged the slots so she would win an astounding $14,000 with a $1 chip. Another mole, one from Polk County, won $8,000 at the luckiest slots this side of Vegas. The two winners posed for photos with Chief Larry as he ceremoniously handed over greatly enlarged checks, and Bobby Carl paid for full-page ads in 8 weekly newspapers, including the Ford County Times. The lure of instant riches was overwhelming. Business doubled, then tripled. After 6 weeks, the Lucky Jack was breaking even. The hotel offered free rooms with weekend packages and often had no vacancies. RVs began arriving from other states. Billboards all over North Mississippi advertised the good life at the Lucky Jack. The good life was passing Stella by. She was 48, the mother of 1 fully grown daughter, and the wife of a man she no longer loved. When she had married Sidney decades earlier, she had known he was dull, quiet, and not particularly handsome, and lacked ambition. And now, as she approached the age of 50, she could not remember why or how he had attracted her. The romance and lust didn't last long, and by the time their daughter was born, they were simply going through the motions. On Stella's 30th birthday, she confided to a sister that she really wasn't happy. Her sister, once divorced, with another one in the works, advised her to unload Sidney and find a man with a personality, someone who enjoyed life, someone with assets, preferably. Instead, Stella doted on her daughter and secretly began taking birth control pills. The thought of another child with even a few of Sidney's genes was not appealing. 18 years had passed now, and the daughter was gone. Sidney had put on a few pounds and was graying and sedentary and duller than ever. He worked as a data collector for a mid-sized life insurance company and was content to put in his years and dream of some glorious retirement that he, for some reason, believed would be far more exciting than the first 65 years of his life. Stella knew better. She knew that Sidney, whether working or retired, would be the same insufferable mouse of a man whose silly little daily rituals would never change and would eventually drive her crazy. She wanted out. She knew he still loved her, adored her even, but she could not return the affection. She tried for years to convince herself that their marriage was still anchored in love, that of the long-lasting, non-romantic, deeply embedded type that survives decade after decade, but she finally gave up this fatal notion. She hated to break his heart, but he would eventually get over it. She dropped 20 pounds, darkened her hair, went a bit heavier with the makeup, and flirted with the idea of some new breasts. Sidney watched this with amusement. His cute wife now looked 10 years younger. What a lucky man he was. His luck ran out, though, when he came home one night to an empty house. Most of the furniture was still there, but his wife was not. Her closets were empty. She had taken some linens and kitchen accessories, but had not been greedy about it. Truth was, Stella wanted nothing from Sidney but a divorce. The paperwork was on the kitchen table, a joint petition for divorce on the grounds of irreconcilable differences, prepared by a lawyer already. It was an ambush. He wept as he read it, then cried even harder as he read her rather terse 2-page farewell. For a week or so, they bickered on the phone, back and forth, back and forth. He begged her to come home. She declined, said it was over, so please just sign the paperwork and stop crying. They had lived for years on the outskirts of the small town of Caraway, a desolate little place, well-suited for a man like Sidney. Stella, however, had had enough. She was now in Clanton, the county seat, a larger town with a country club and a few lounges. She was living with an old girlfriend, sleeping in the basement, looking for a job. Sidney tried to find her, but she avoided him. Their daughter called from Texas and quickly sided with her mother. The house, always on the quiet side, was now like a tomb, and Sidney couldn't stand it. He developed the ritual of waiting until dark, then driving to Clanton, around the square, up and down the streets of the town, eyes moving from side to side, hoping fervently that he would see his wife, and that she would see him, and that her cruel heart would melt and life would be good again. He never saw her, and he kept driving, out of the town, and into the countryside. One night he passed Chief Larry's store and down the road turned into the crowded parking lot of the Lucky Jack Casino. Maybe she'd be there. Maybe she was so desperate for the bright lights and the fast life that she would stoop to hang out in such a trashy place. It was just a thought, just an excuse to see the action that everyone had been talking about. Who would have ever dreamed that a casino would exist in the hidebound rural outback of Ford County? Sidney roamed the tacky carpet, spoke to Chief Larry, watched a group of drunk rednecks lose their paychecks shooting craps, sneered at the pathetic geezers stuffing their savings into rigged slot machines, and listened briefly to a dreadful country crooner trying to imitate Hank Williams on a small stage in the rear. A few middle-aged and very overweight swingers wobbled and shifted listlessly on the dance floor in front of the band. Some real hellraisers. Stella wasn't there. She wasn't in the bar, nor the buffet cafeteria, nor the poker room. Sidney was somewhat relieved, but his heart was still broken. He hadn't played cards in years, but he remembered the basic rules of 21, a game his father had taught him. After circling the blackjack tables for half an hour, he finally mustered the courage to slide into a seat at the $5 table and get change for a $20 bill. He played for an hour and won $85. He spent the next day studying the rules of blackjack, the basic odds, doubling down, splitting pairs, the ins and outs of buying insurance, and returned to the same table the following night and won over $400. He studied some more. And the third night he played for 3 hours, drank nothing but black coffee, and walked away with $1,750. He found the game to be simple and straightforward. There was a perfect way to play each hand based on what the dealer was showing, and following the standard odds, a player can win 6 hands out of 10. Add the 2-for-1 payout for hitting a blackjack, and the game provided the best odds against the house. Why, then, did so many people lose? Sidney was appalled at the other players' lack of knowledge and their foolish bets. The nonstop alcohol didn't help, and in a land where drinking was repressed and still considered a major sin, the free flow of booze at the Lucky Jack was irresistible for many. Sidney studied, played, drank free black coffee brought in by the cocktail waitresses, and played some more. He bought books and self-help videos and taught himself to count cards, a difficult strategy that often worked beautifully, but would also get a gambler thrown out of most casinos. And, most important, he taught himself the discipline necessary to play the odds, to quit when he was losing, and to radically change his bets as the deck grew smaller. He stopped driving to Clanton to look for his wife, and instead drove straight to the Lucky Jack, where, on most nights, he would play for an hour or two and take home at least $1,000. The more he won, the more he noticed the hard frowns from the pit bosses. The beefy young men in cheap suits, security, he guessed, seemed to watch him a bit closer. He continually refused to be raided, the process of signing up for club membership that gave all sorts of freebies to those regulars who gambled hard. He refused to register in any way. His favorite book was How to Break the Casino, and the author, an ex-gambler turned writer, preached the message of disguise and deceit. Never wear the same clothes, jewelry, hats, caps, glasses. Never play at the same table for more than an hour. Never give them your name. Take a friend and tell him to call you Frank or Charlie or something. Make a stupid bet occasionally. Change your drink routine, but stay away from alcohol. The reason was simple. The law allowed any casino in the country to simply ask a gambler to leave. If they suspect you're counting cards or cheating, or if you're winning too much and they're just tired of it, they can give you the boot. No reason is necessary. An assortment of identities keeps them guessing. The success of the gambling gave Sidney a new purpose in life, but in the darkness of the night, he still awoke and reached for Stella. The divorce decree had been signed by a judge. She was not coming back. But he reached anyway, still dreaming of the woman he would always love. Stella was not suffering from loneliness, The news of an attractive new divorced woman in town spread quickly. And before long, she found herself at a party where she met the infamous Bobby Carl Leach. Though she was somewhat older than most of the women he chased, he nonetheless found her attractive and sexy. He charmed her with his usual stream of compliments and seemed to hang on every word she uttered. They had dinner the following night and went to bed right after dessert. Though he was rough and vulgar, she found the experience exhilarating. It was so wonderfully different from the stoic and chilly copulating she had endured with Sidney. Before long, Stella had a well-paying job as an assistant/secretary for Mr. Leach, the latest in a long line of women who were added to the payroll for reasons other than their organizational skills. But if Mr. Leach expected her to do little more than answer the phone and strip on demand, he miscalculated badly. She quickly surveyed his empire and found little of interest. Timber, raw land, rental property, farm equipment, and low-budget motels were all as dull as Sidney, especially when weighed against the glitz of a casino. She belonged at the Lucky Jack, and soon commandeered an office upstairs above the gaming floor, where Bobby Carl roamed in the late evenings, gin and tonic in hand, staring at the innumerable video cameras and counting his money. Her title shifted to that of Director of Operations, and she began planning an expansion of the dining area and maybe an indoor pool. She had lots of ideas, and Bobby Carl was pleased to have an easy bedmate who felt just as much passion for the business. Back in Caraway, Sidney soon heard the rumors that his beloved Stella had taken up with that rogue Leach, and this further depressed him. It made him ill. He thought of murder, then suicide. He dreamed of ways to impress her and to win her back. When he heard that she was running the casino, he stopped going. But he did not stop gambling. Instead, he broadened his game with long weekends at the casinos in Tunica County on the Mississippi River. He won $14,000 in a marathon session at the Choctaw Casino in Neshoba County, and was asked to leave the Grand Casino in Biloxi after wiping out two tables to the tune of $38,000. He took a week of vacation and went to Vegas, where he played at a different casino every 4 hours and left town with over $60,000 in winnings. He quit his job and spent 2 weeks in the Bahamas, raking in piles of $100 chips at every casino in Freeport and Nassau. He bought an RV and toured the country, prowling for any reservation with a casino. Of the dozen or so he found, all were glad to see him leave. Then he spent a month back in Vegas, studying at the private table of the world's greatest teacher, the man who'd written How to Break the Casino. The one-on-one tutorial cost Sidney $50,000, but it was worth every penny. His teacher convinced him he had the talent, the discipline, and the nerves to play blackjack professionally. Such praise was rarely given. After 4 months, the Lucky Jack had settled nicely into the local scene. All opposition to it faded. The casino was obviously not going away. It became a popular meeting place for civic clubs, class reunions, bachelor parties, even a few weddings. Chief Larry began planning the construction of a Yazoo headquarters, and he was thrilled to see his tribe growing. Folks who'd been quite resistant to the suggestion of Indian ancestry now proudly claimed to be full-blooded Yazoo. Most wanted jobs, and when Chief broached the idea of sharing the profits in the form of monthly handouts, his tribe ballooned to over 100 members. Bobby Carl, of course, pocketed his share of the revenues, but he had yet to become greedy. Instead, and with Stella's prodding, he borrowed even more money to finance a golf course and a convention center. The bank was pleasantly astonished at the flow of cash and quickly extended the credit. 6 months after it opened, the Lucky Jack was $2 million in debt, and no one was worried. During the 26 years she'd spent with Sidney, Stella had never left the country and had seen very little of the United States. His idea of a vacation had been a cheap rental at a beach in Florida, and never for more than 5 days. Her new man, though, loved boats and cruises, and because of this, she cooked up the idea of a Valentine's cruise in the Caribbean for 10 lucky couples. She advertised the competition, rigged the results, picked some of her new friends and a few of Bobby Carl's, then announced the winners in yet another large ad in the local newspapers. And away they went. Bobby Carl and Stella, and a handful of casino executives. Chief Larry declined, much to their relief. And the 10 lucky couples left Clanton in limos for the trip to the airport in Memphis. From there, they flew to Miami and boarded a ship with 4,000 others for an intimate jaunt through the islands. When they were out of the country, the Valentine's Day massacre began. Sydney entered the Lucky Jack on a busy night. Stella had advertised all sorts of cheap romantic freebies, and the place was packed. He was Sydney, but he looked nothing like the Sydney last seen at the casino. His hair was long and stringy, darkly tinted, and hanging over his ears. He hadn't shaved in a month, and his beard was colored with the same cheap dye he'd used on his hair. He wore large, round, tortoise-shell glasses, also tinted, and his eyes were hard to see. He wore a leather biker's jacket and jeans, and six of his fingers bore rings of various stones and metals. A baffling black beret covered most of his head and drooped to the left. For the benefit of the security boys upstairs at their monitors, the back of each hand was adorned with an obscene fake tattoo. No one had ever seen this Sydney. Of the 20 blackjack tables, only three catered to the high rollers. Their minimum bets were $100 a hand, and these tables generally saw little traffic. Sydney assumed a chair at one, tossed out a bundle of cash, and said, $5,000 in $100 chips. The dealer smiled as he took the cash and spread it across the table. A pit boss watched carefully over his shoulder. Stares and nods were exchanged around the pit, and the eyes upstairs came to life. There were two other gamblers at the table, and they hardly noticed. Both were drinking and were down to their last few chips. Sydney played like an amateur and lost $2,000 in 20 minutes. The pit boss relaxed. Nothing to worry about. "Do you have a club card?" he asked Sydney. "No," came a curt reply that said, "and don't offer me one." The other two men left the table, and Sydney spread out his operations. Playing three seats and betting $500 at each one, he quickly recaptured his $2,000 and added another $4,500 to his stack of chips. The pit boss paced a little and tried not to stare. The dealer shuffled the cards as a cocktail waitress brought a vodka and orange juice, a drink Sydney sipped but barely consumed. Playing four seats at $1,000 each, he broke even for the next 15 minutes, then won six hands in a row for a total of $24,000. The $100 chips were too numerous to move around quickly, so he said, "Let's switch to those purple ones." The table had only 20 of the $1,000 chips. The dealer was forced to call time out as the pit boss sent for more money. "Would you like dinner?" the dealer asked, somewhat nervously. "Not hungry," Sydney said, "but I'll run to the men's room." When play resumed, Sydney, still alone at the table and attracting a few onlookers, played four seats at $2,000 each. He broke even for 15 minutes, then glanced at the pit boss and abruptly asked, "Can I have another dealer?" "Certainly." "I prefer a female." "No problem." A young Hispanic lady stepped to the table and offered a feeble, "Good luck." Sydney did not respond. He played $1,000 at each of four seats, lost three in a row, then increased his bets to $3,000 a hand and won four straight. The casino was down $60,000. The blackjack record so far at the Lucky Jack was $110,000 for one night. A doctor from Memphis had made the haul, only to lose it and much more the following night. "Let 'em win," Bobby Carl loved to say. "We'll get it right back." "I'd like some ice cream," Sydney said in the general direction of the pit boss, who immediately snapped his fingers. "What flavor?" "Pistachio." A plastic bowl and spoon soon arrived, and Sydney tipped the waitress with his last $100 chip. He took a small bite, then placed $5,000 at four seats. playing $20,000 a hand was indeed rare, and the gossip spread through the casino. A crowd hovered behind him, but he was oblivious. He won 7 of the next 10 hands and was up $102,000. As the dealer shuffled the decks, Sidney slowly ate the ice cream and did nothing else but stare at the cards. With a fresh shoe, he varied his bets from $10,000 to $20,000 per hand. When he won $80,000 more, the pit boss stepped in and said, "That's enough, you're counting cards." "You're wrong," Sidney said. "Let him go," someone said behind him, but the pit boss ignored it. The dealer backed away from the confrontation. "You're counting," the pit boss said again. "It's not illegal," Sidney shot back. "No, but we make our own rules." "You're full of crap," Sidney growled, then took another bite. "That's it. I'll ask you to leave." "Fine. I want cash." "We'll cut a check." "Hell no. I walked in here with cash, and I'm leaving with cash." "Sir, would you please come with me?" "Where?" Sidney demanded. "Let's handle this over at the cashier's." "Great," Sidney said, "but I demand cash." The crowd watched them disappear. In the cashier's office, Sidney produced a fake driver's license that declared him to be a Mr. Jack Ross from Dothan, Alabama. The cashier and the pit boss filled out the required IRS form, and after a heated argument, Sidney walked out of the casino with a canvas bank bag filled with $184,000 in $100 bills. He was back the following night in a dark suit, white shirt, and tie, and looking considerably different. The beard, long hair, rings, tattoos, beret, and goofy glasses were gone. His head was shaved slick, and he sported a narrow gray mustache and wire-rimmed reading glasses perched on his nose. He chose a different table with a different dealer. Last night's pit boss was not on duty. He put cash on the table and asked for 24 $1,000 chips. He played for 30 minutes, won 12 hands out of 15, then asked for a private table. The pit boss led him to a small room near the poker pit. The security boys upstairs were standing at their posts, watching every move. "I'd like $10,000 chips," Sidney announced, "and a male dealer." "No problem. Something to drink?" "A Sprite with some pretzels." He pulled some more cash from his pocket and counted the chips after the exchange. There were 20 of them. He played 3 seats at a time, and 15 minutes later, he owned 32 chips. Another pit boss and the manager on duty had joined the occasion and stood behind the dealer, watching grimly. Sidney munched on pretzels as if he were playing $2 slots. Instead, he was now betting $10,000 at each of 4 seats, then $20,000, then back to $10,000. When the shoe was low, he suddenly bet $50,000 at all 6 seats. The dealer was showing a 5, his worst card. Sidney calmly split 2 sevens and doubled down on a hard 10. The dealer flipped a queen, then very slowly pulled his next card. It was a 9 for a bust of 24. The hand netted Sidney $400,000. And the first pit boss was ready to faint. "Perhaps we should take a break," the manager said. "Oh, I say we finish the shoe, then take a break," Sidney said. "No," the manager said. "You want the money back, don't you?" Sidney asked. The dealer hesitated and cast a desperate look at the manager. Where was Bobby Carl when they needed him? "Deal," Sidney said with a grin. "It's just money. Hell, I've never walked out of a casino with cash in my pocket." "Could we have your name?" "Sure. It's Sidney Lewis." He removed his wallet, tossed over his real driver's license, and didn't care if they had his real name. He had no plans to return. The manager and pit bosses studied it. Anything to buy some time. "Have you been here before?" the manager asked. "I was here a few months ago. Are we going to play? What kind of casino is this? Now deal the cards." The manager reluctantly returned the license, and Sidney left it on the table, next to his towering collection of chips. The manager then nodded slowly at the dealer. Sidney had a single $10,000 chip at each of the six seats, then quickly added four more to each. $300,000 was suddenly in play. If he won half the seats, he planned to keep playing. If he lost, he'd quit and walk out with a two-night net of about $600,000, a pleasant sum of money that would do much to satisfy his hatred of Bobby Carl Leach. Cards slowly hit the table, and the dealer gave himself a six as his up card. Sidney split two jacks, a gutsy move that most experts warned against. Then he waved off further draws. When the dealer flipped his down card and revealed a nine, Sidney showed no expression, but the manager and both pit bosses turned pale. The dealer was required to draw on a 15, and he did so with great reluctance. He pulled a seven for a bust of 22. The manager jumped forward and said, "That's it, you're counting cards." He wiped beads of sweat from his forehead. Sidney said, "You must be kidding. What kind of dump is this?" "It's over, buddy," the manager said, then glanced at the two thick security guards who had suddenly materialized behind Sidney, who calmly stuck a pretzel in his mouth and crunched it loudly. He grinned at the manager and the pit bosses and decided to call it a night. "I want cash," he said. That might be a problem," the manager said. They escorted Sidney to the manager's office upstairs, where the entire entourage gathered behind a closed door. No one sat down. "I demand cash," Sidney said. "We'll give you a check," the manager said again. "You don't have the cash, do you?" Sidney said, taunting. "This two-bit casino doesn't have the cash and cannot cover its exposure." "We have the money," the manager said without conviction, "and we're happy to write a check." Sidney glared at him and at the two pit bosses and at the two security guards, then said, "The check will bounce, won't it?" "Of course not. But I'll ask you to hold it for 72 hours. "Which bank?" "Merchants Bank in Clanton." At 9 o'clock the next morning, Sidney and his lawyer walked into the Merchants Bank on the square in Clanton and demanded to see the president. When they were in his office, Sidney pulled out a check from the Lucky Jack Casino in the amount of $945,000, post-dated 3 days. The president examined it, wiped his face, then said in a cracking voice, "I'm sorry, but we can't honor this check." "And in 3 days?" the lawyer asked. "I seriously doubt it." "Have you talked to the casino?" the lawyer asked. "Yes, several times." An hour later, Sidney and his lawyer walked into the Ford County Courthouse, to the office of the Chancery Clerk, and filed a petition for a temporary restraining order seeking an immediate closing of the Lucky Jack and the payment of the debt. The judge, the Honorable Willis Bradshaw, set an emergency hearing for 9 o'clock the following morning. Bobby Carl jumped ship in Puerto Rico and scrambled to find flights back to Memphis. He arrived in Ford County late in the evening and drove, in a rented Hertz subcompact, straight to the casino, where he found few gamblers and even fewer employees who knew anything about what had happened the previous night. The manager had quit and could not be found. One of the pit bosses who dealt with Sidney was likewise rumored to have fled the county. Bobby Carl threatened to fire everyone else, except for Chief Larry, who was overwhelmed by the chaos. At midnight, Bobby Carl was meeting with the bank president and a team of lawyers, and the anxiety level was through the roof. Stella was still on the cruise ship, but unable to enjoy herself. In the midst of the chaos, when Bobby Carl was screaming into the phone and throwing things, she had heard him yell, "Sidney Lewis? Who the hell is Sidney Lewis?" She said nothing, at least nothing about the Sidney Lewis she knew, and found it impossible to believe that her ex-husband had been capable of breaking a casino. Still, she was very uncomfortable, and when the ship docked at Georgetown on Grand Cayman, she took a cab to the airport and headed home. Judge Bradshaw welcomed the throng of spectators to his courtroom. He thanked them for coming and invited them back in the future. Then he asked the lawyers if they were ready to proceed. Bobby Carl, red-eyed and haggard and unshaven, was seated at one table with three of his lawyers and Chief Larry, who'd never been near a courtroom, and was so nervous that he simply closed his eyes and appeared to be meditating. Bobby Carl, who'd seen many courtrooms, was nonetheless just as stressed. Everything he owned had been mortgaged for the bank loan, and now the future of his casino, as well as all other assets, was in great jeopardy. One of his lawyers stood quickly and said, "Yes, Judge, we are ready, but we have filed a motion to dismiss this proceeding because of a lack of jurisdiction. This matter belongs in federal court, not state." "I've read your motion," Judge Bradshaw said, and it was obvious he did not like what he had read. "I'm keeping jurisdiction," he said. "Then we'll file in federal court later this morning," the lawyer shot back. Judge Bradshaw said, "I can't stop you from filing anything." He had spent most of his career trying to sort out the ugly disputes between feuding couples, and over the years he had developed an intense dislike for the causes of divorce. Alcohol, drugs, adultery, gambling. His involvement with the major vices was never ending. He taught Sunday school in the Methodist Church and had strict beliefs about right and wrong. Gambling was an abomination, in his opinion, and he was delighted to have a crack at it. Sidney's lawyer argued loud and hard that the casino was undercapitalized and maintained insufficient cash reserves. Thus, it was an ongoing threat to other gamblers. He announced he was filing a full-blown lawsuit at 5 that afternoon if the casino did not honor its debt to his client. In the meantime, though, the casino should be closed. Judge Bradshaw seemed to favor this idea, and so did the crowd. The spectators included quite a few preachers and their followers, all good registered voters who had always supported Judge Bradshaw, and all bright-eyed and happy at the possibility of shutting down the casino. This was the miracle they had been praying for. And though they silently condemned Sidney for his sinful ways, they couldn't help but admire the guy, a local boy, for breaking the casino. Go, Sidney. As the hearing dragged on, it came to light that the Lucky Jack had cash on hand of about $400,000, and in addition, there was a $500,000 reserve fund secured by a bond. Also, Bobby Carl admitted on the witness stand that the casino had averaged about $80,000 a month in profits for the first 7 months, and that this number was rising steadily. After a grueling 5-hour hearing, Judge Bradshaw ordered the casino to pay the entire $945,000 immediately and close the doors until the debt was satisfied. He also instructed the sheriff to block the entrance off the state highway and to arrest any gambler who tried to enter. Lawyers for the Lucky Jack ran to federal court in Oxford and filed papers to reopen. A hearing would take several days to organize. As promised, Sidney filed suit in both state and federal courts. Over the next few days, more lawsuits flew back and forth. Sidney sued the insurance company that issued the bond, then sued the bank as well. The bank, suddenly nervous about the $2 million it had loaned to Lucky Jack, soured on the once exciting gaming business. It called the loan and sued the Yazoo Nation, Chief Larry, and Bobby Carl Leach. They countersued, alleging all sorts of unfair practices. The burst of litigation electrified the local lawyers, most of whom jockeyed for a piece of the action. When Bobby Carl learned that Stella's recently divorced husband was in fact Sidney, he accused her of conspiring with him and fired her. She sued. Days passed, and the Lucky Jack remained closed. 24 unpaid employees filed suit. Federal regulators issued subpoenas. The federal judge wanted no part of the mess and dismissed the casino's efforts to reopen. After a month of frantic legal maneuvering, reality settled in. The casino's future looked dire. Bobby Carl convinced Chief Larry that they had no choice but to file for bankruptcy protection. 2 days later, Bobby Carl reluctantly did the same. After 2 decades of wheeling and dealing and operating on the edge, he was finally bankrupt. Sidney was in Las Vegas when he received a call from his lawyer with the great news that the insurance company would settle for the full amount of its bond, $500,000. In addition, the frozen accounts of the Lucky Jack would be thawed just enough so that another check for $400,000 would be issued in his favor. He immediately hopped in his RV and made a leisurely and triumphant journey back to Ford County, but not before hitting 3 Indian casinos along the way. Bobby Carl's favorite arsonists were a husband and wife duo from Arkansas. Contact was made, cash changed hands, a set of building plans and keys were passed along, the nighttime security guards at the casino were fired, its water supply was cut off, the building had no sprinkler system because no building code required one. By the time the Springdale Volunteer Fire Brigade arrived on the scene at 3 a.m., the Lucky Jack was fully ablaze. Its metal frame structures were melting. Inspectors later suspected arson, but found no trace of gasoline or other incendiaries. A natural gas leak and explosion had started the fire, they decided. During the ensuing litigation, investigators for the insurance company would produce records which revealed that the casino's natural gas tanks had been mysteriously filled only a week before the fire. Chief Larry returned to his store and fell into a state of severe depression. Once again, his tribe had been demolished by the white man's greed. His Yazoo Nation scattered, never to be seen again. Sidney hung around Caraway for a while, but grew weary of the attention and gossip. Since he had quit his job and busted the casino, folks quite naturally referred to him as a professional gambler, a rarity indeed in rural Mississippi. And though Sidney didn't fit the mold of a high-rolling rogue, the topic of his new lifestyle was irresistible. It was well known that he was the only man in town with $1 million, and this caused problems. Old friends materialized. Single women of all ages schemed of ways to meet him. All the charities wrote letters and pleaded for money. His daughter in Texas became more involved in his life and was quick to apologize for taking sides during the divorce. When he put a for sale sign in his front yard, Caraway talked of little else. The hardiest rumor was that he was moving to Las Vegas. He waited. He played poker online for hours, and when he got bored, he drove his RV to the casinos in Tunica or to the Gulf Coast. He won more than he lost, but he was careful not to attract too much attention. 2 casinos in Biloxi had banned him months earlier. He always returned to Caraway, though he really wanted to leave it forever. He waited. The first move was made by his daughter. She called and talked for an hour one night, and toward the end of the rambling conversation, let it slip that Stella was lonely and sad and really missed her life with Sidney. According to the daughter, Stella was consumed with remorse and desperate to reconcile with the only man she would ever love. As Sidney listened to his daughter prattle on, he realized that he needed Stella far more than he disliked her. Still, he made no promises. The next phone call was more to the point. The daughter began an effort to broker a meeting between her parents, sort of a first step to normalize relations. She was willing to return to Caraway and mediate matters if necessary. All she wanted was for her parents to be together. How odd, thought Sidney, since she expressed no such thoughts before he broke the casino. After a week or so of shadowboxing, Stella showed up one night for a glass of tea. In a lengthy, emotional meeting, she confessed her sins and begged for forgiveness. She left and returned the next night for another discussion. On the third night, they went to bed, and Sidney was in love again. Without discussing marriage, they loaded up the RV and took off to Florida. Near Ocala, the Seminole tribe was operating a fabulous new casino, and Sidney was eager to attack it. He was feeling lucky. Michael's room. The encounter was probably inevitable in a town of 10,000 people. Sooner or later, you're bound to bump into almost everyone, including those whose names are long forgotten and whose faces are barely familiar. Some names and faces are registered and remembered and withstand the erosion of time. Others are almost instantly discarded, and most for good reason. For Stanley Wade, the encounter was caused in part by his wife's lingering flu, and in part by their need for sustenance, along with other reasons. After a long day at the office, he called home to check on her and to inquire about dinner. She rather abruptly informed him that she had no desire to cook and little desire to eat, and that if he was hungry, he'd better stop by the store. When was he not hungry at dinner time? After a few more sentences, they agreed on frozen pizza, about the only dish Stanley could prepare and, oddly, the only thing she might possibly want to nibble on, preferably sausage and cheese. "Please enter through the kitchen and keep the dogs quiet," she instructed. "She might be asleep on the sofa." The nearest food store was the Right Price, an old discount house a few blocks off the square, with dirty aisles and low prices and cheap giveaways that attracted the lower classes. Most uppity whites used the new Kroger south of town, far out of Stanley's way. But it was only a frozen pizza. What difference did it make? He wasn't shopping for the freshest organic produce on this occasion. He was hungry and looking for junk and just wanted to get home. He ignored the shopping carts and baskets and went straight to the frozen section, where he selected a 14-inch creation with an Italian name and freshness guaranteed. He was closing the icy glass door when he became aware of someone standing very near him, someone who'd seen him, followed him, and was now practically breathing on him, someone much larger than Stanley, someone who had no interest in frozen foods, at least not at that moment. Stanley turned to his right and locked eyes with a smirking and unhappy face he had seen somewhere before. The man was about 40, roughly 10 years younger than Stanley, at least 4 inches taller, and much thicker through the chest. Stanley was slight, almost fragile, not the least bit athletic. "You're Lawyer Wade, ain't you?" the man said, but it was far more an accusation than a question. Even the voice was vaguely familiar, unusually high-pitched for such a hulking figure, rural but not ignorant. A voice from the past, no doubt about that. Stanley correctly assumed that their previous meeting, whenever and wherever, concerned a lawsuit of some variety, and it didn't take a genius to surmise that they had not been on the same side. Coming face to face with old courtroom adversaries long after a trial is a hazard for many small-town lawyers. As much as he was tempted, Stanley could not bring himself to deny who he was. "That's right," he said, clutching his pizza. "And you are?" With that, the man suddenly moved past Stanley, and in doing so, lowered his shoulder slightly and landed a solid hit against Lawyer Wade, who was knocked against the icy door he had just closed. The pizza fell to the floor, and as Stanley balanced himself and reached for his dinner, he turned and saw the man disappear around a corner and down the aisle in the direction of the breakfast foods and coffee. Stanley caught his breath, glanced around, started to yell something provocative, but quickly thought better of it, then stood for a moment and tried to analyze the only harsh physical contact he could remember during his adult life. He had never been a fighter, athlete, drinker, hellraiser. Not Stanley. He'd been the thinker, the scholar, top third of his law class. It was an assault, pure and simple, the least touching of another in anger. But there were no witnesses, and Stanley wisely decided to forget about it, or at least try. Given the disparity in their sizes and dispositions, it certainly could have been much worse. And it would be, very shortly.